Thanks for listening to the Best of the Doug Gottlieb Show podcast. Be sure to catch us live every weekday from 3 to 6 p.m. Eastern Time. That's 12 to 3 Pacific on Fox Sports Radio. Find your local station for the Doug Gottlieb Show at foxsportsradio.com or stream us live every day on the iHeartRadio app by searching FSR.
This is the Best of the Doug Gottlieb Show on Fox Sports Radio.
Boom! What up, America? Doug Gottlieb Show, Fox Sports Radio. Opening day, Major League Baseball. Hello. New York. Hello. Man, baseball. It's almost like you weren't gone. But you're back. Lot to get to today. Amazing show lined out for you by talented producer Ryan Music and, of course, a booker extraordinaire, Cindy Katz. We'll get to that in a second. The Doug Gottlieb Show is brought to you by Farmers. At Farmers, we've seen almost everything. So we know how to cover almost anything. When it's game time, put an experienced player to help have an experienced player to help you stay ahead of the game. Put their experience into play at Farmers.com.
We are Farmers. Bum, 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 bum.
Here's what we got for you, okay? This hour, Mike DeCourcy, who works for Sporting News and the Big Ten Network, will join us. We'll get you ready for the Sweet 16, which tips back off tonight. I'm 15 minutes from my casa at 4:30 West Coast time. That's 7:30 East Coast time, I believe. So you got games that'll go late into the evening if you're on the East Coast, West Coast. It'll fit perfectly into our television viewing. Get you ready. Got some picks for you. I think I can make you some money. Brian Baldinger will join us next hour. So too will Nick Swisher. We'll get you ready for Major League Baseball season. Jason Terry will be our guest, as will Chris Mannix. We'll try and figure out what the heck happened to the Thunder. Thunder looked good last night, but they've looked equally putrid much of the last month of the season, kind of going undiscussed. And then we'll talk about this weird Jordan Bell situation where, I don't know if you were listening like I was intently to Dan Beyer with the updates, but Jordan Bell was suspended for conduct detrimental to the team. Apparently, he charged a bunch of stuff to Mike Brown's room. I got to find out what he charged to Mike Brown's room, right? Like, was he like eating filet mignon and everything and just charging everything up to, and every time Brownie went to the front desk to check out, to like, Mr. Brown, you got more movies here than, or was it some sort of joke that's gone? I got to know what there's got to be more to this. Got to be more to this. Let's start with Bryce Harper, because yesterday we shared with you a poll that's been done of players where Bryce Harper is considered the most, among players, the most overrated player in Major League Baseball. According to The Athletic, 62% of the poll respondents voted Bryce Harper as the most overrated player in baseball. And I don't know how it's going to turn out for Bryce Harper in Philly. Philly is a passionate sports town, one that he has signed up for the rest of his professional life to play in. It's a ballpark that fits perfectly into the way in which he hits. You basically got a jet stream to left center and to right center. Get it up in the air and it is gone. You get a very good young team in a division where, you know, the Braves are super dangerous. The Mets have a couple of pitchers but seem to be sort of in rebuild mode. The Nationals, well, you took out the legs from under the Nationals, taking away their best hitter, but the Nationals still have a prodigious amount of talent in their rotation, especially, and that's still a good baseball team. The Marlins are trying to tank. So you have the ability to win there. But it's interesting. What the future holds for Bryce Harper, I can't tell you exactly, but I can give you a sense. Everybody wants to be the big, high-priced free agent. Everybody wants to be the guy that everybody wants. Or at least that's what they think they want before they become the guy that everybody wants. You see a little bit of this with Kyrie Irving, who, even though he's not yet a free agent, has yet to be able to control where he goes. He can this offseason. He's enjoyed it so little that he's already had many missteps with the media and had to apologize for things he said and the way in which he's acted. Then you have LeBron James, who the first time around as a free agent, of course, got chastised for having that weird press conference in Connecticut, only to announce he was going to Miami without calling Cleveland beforehand. LeBron's first year in Miami was somewhat of a success. They did get to the NBA Finals. They just lost. They lost in six games to the Dallas Mavericks, a series which kind of went astray no one ever blamed Mike Bibby, who played very, very poorly, so bad, in fact, that after starting games 1 through 5, didn't even play in game 6. Instead, all the blame was thrust on LeBron. And because he struggled so much to recapture his name, to recapture like luster of the past, like he struggled wearing the dark hat of being the bad guy for leaving Cleveland. Kevin Durant left Oklahoma City 2 years ago, 2.5 years ago. And since, he's won 2 NBA MVPs and 2 NBA championships and won exactly 0 people over, even though he's really been the best player in the sport for the last 2 years. Hell, Kirk Cousins, who signed a 3-year guaranteed contract and did not take the most money available, is seen as a flop so far in Minnesota because they didn't make the playoffs when he was 2nd in completion percentage, 10th in overall yardage, 9th in touchdowns, and he only had 10 interceptions. That's a 3-to-1 TD to interception ratio. That's inside the top 10 for qualified passers. The point is that nothing Bryce Harper does is probably going to be enough, considering how much he makes and how lusted over he was. Maybe that's why Bryce Harper doesn't want to be a free agent anymore in his career, because he realizes that. But I don't know how many other people realize that. Right, here are the Philadelphia Phillies. They're getting ready to take on the Atlanta Braves. And because of the attention and the number, $330 million in the years, 13 years, he's going to be expected to carry a baseball team. Carry them. And that's not really what Bryce Harper does, to be totally honest. He's a good player who has MVP potential. But he's been all over the map throughout his Major League Baseball career in terms of consistency of production, right? I mean, that's really the kind of reality of it. I mean, Bryce Harper, his first year in the bigs was in 2012. The most 2 years he's played over 150 games. His first year he played 139 games, but he's had a couple of injury-plagued seasons, playing 118 games or less, missing a third of the season, essentially. And while his batting average has been at a peak at 330, it's been at a low of last year of 249 last year. His on-base percentage has also varied from 340 to 460 back to 393 last year. Here's a guy that's been consistently inconsistent, has a ton of talent, is already thought to being overrated, now signs as the number one free agent, and the expectation is only going to be peak, and that's probably not even who he is. Being the first pick, of any draft is a lot like being the big free agent of the offseason. Right? It's just different. It's going to be different for Zion. You know, it's going to be different for Zion if he goes 1 as opposed to if he goes 2. And we've had plenty of busts as number 2 overall picks. Plenty. But they're not Anthony Bennett. Right? We focus on number 1 picks. They're not Greg Oden's. You know, Hasheem Thabeet, he was out of the league as soon as he was in the league. Nobody points to him as being a bust. Why? He wasn't the number 1 overall pick. The number 1 pick, for whatever reason, is seen as one which you have to be so far superior to everybody else. That's part of the Markelle Fultz thing. Fultz hasn't just been bad, and Fultz has had this weird shoulder thing and mental thing or whatever. And then, of course, guys drafted behind him like a Donovan Mitchell have exploded onto the scene. But the fact that he was the number one pick, you could have taken anybody, and this is the guy you took, and he flames out, that's worse. That's the same exact thing with the number one lusted after free agent. And that's what Bryce Harper has in front of him. I don't know how to play out, but my guess is no matter what he does, we'll be underwhelmed by it. Because if you take a good, strong look at what Kevin Durant has done, you'd have to sit there and go, well, Kevin Durant, no brainer. He has been a success, but has it been? I guess. They've won two championships. He's won two finals MVPs. They got a chance to win a third championship. He's probably the best player in the sport, but he's not regarded as such. Some of it's his own fault with his mishandling of social media and the way in which he kind of handles himself within the working of the team. But a lot of it is how our own expectations that are built up when you change teams and when you're recruited at that high a level to change teams.
Be sure to catch live editions of the Doug Gottlieb Show weekdays at noon Eastern, 3 p.m. Pacific on Fox Sports Radio and the iHeartRadio app.
Mike DeCourcy covers college basketball for The Sporting News. Follow him on Twitter at TSN. That's The Sporting News. TSN Mike. You can also check him out on the Big Ten Network covering college hoops all year long. Stay tuned next week during the Final Four. Will he be releasing his two big projects he's been working on? Maybe he'll give us a hint at those projects, but... look, Mike, I've often said this. First weekend's usually about a Cinderella story, right? Second weekend's like, all right, let's get to the business of deciding a champion. And maybe the best thing about this year is we don't have a Cinderella story for the most part. We have a couple of unique stories and interesting anecdotes, but we probably have 16 of the 20 best teams in the country playing this weekend. It's a unique Sweet 16, is it not?
Yeah, we haven't had very many like this. Every now and then you'll get a lot of high-end teams. I think the last time was something like 08 or 09 that we had this. I think we had 1, 2, 3 all the way across the board about a decade ago or so, but you don't usually get it. And people complain about it because they're accustomed to the upsets of the first round, the Cinderellas. But the truth is, when you get to this round, a lot of times you get those real Cinderellas, the ones that are very fortunate to win two games, and they're not really competitive when they get here. And I'm not talking about Loyola from a year ago. That was a great team, and they had to beat two really good teams to get to the Sweet 16. And when they came in to the Sweet 16, I don't think there was anybody that didn't think they had a chance to win two games. So I think you're looking at this year with pretty much everybody being a high major, everybody being a very accomplished team. I went through, and as I counted it up, there were 11 teams in the Sweet 16 that had won either the regular season or the tournament championship in their conference. And some of them, of course, won both, like Michigan State, and only five that didn't. And the five that didn't averaged 29 wins. So you're talking about a loaded Sweet 16, and it makes these eight games really intriguing.
All right, so which game to you jumps out as the most interesting?
I think that in a lot of ways the most interesting is Purdue against Tennessee, because the matchups and the way the two coaches have to arrange things is fascinating to me. Purdue has used Nojel Eastern to guard basically one to a small four. If you have a really versatile four man, they might even put him on that guy. Nojel's a 6'6" point guard. Who is a very unconventional player, but a great defender. And so the first question is, what does Purdue do with him? Do you use him against someone like Admiral Schofield? I don't think they'd try him against Grant Williams, because Grant's bigger than the kind of player that Nojel would ordinarily guard. Or do you go and put him on Jordan Bone at the point and sort of cut off the offense from the start? That's, to me, very intriguing. And how does Nojel fare in whatever matchup that he faces? What does Kyle Alexander do with the multiple threats inside of a 7'3" dynamic center in Matt Harms, or the power-based Travion Williams, who can catch just about anything you throw his way, is a really good passer if you double him? I think there are a lot of strategic differences that they can use that make that game really fascinating.
Yeah, I personally, though, don't like the matchup for Tennessee, because who's Grady Eifert going to guard?
Well, I mean, I think he ends up having to guard Grant Williams, and that becomes a real challenge. But he's faced terrific players all through the Big Ten regular season, and the one thing, if you watch them a lot, Grady always is in the right place at the right time, and I haven't seen him get overwhelmed in a matchup yet. This may be his most challenging yet because of the nature of Grant's game, if indeed that's where he goes, and I think it's what it will be. It's going to be a real challenge for Purdue, but with Alexander not being a great offensive threat, whoever guards Williams should have a fair amount of help from either Williams or from Harms.
Yeah, I was at that Purdue Minnesota game, and I saw what's his name,
Jordan Murphy.
Jordan Murphy, you know, give him fits. You know, I feel like that's the blueprint there. If you're Tennessee, is find a way to isolate Grant Williams on Grady Eifert, and therein kind of lies the mismatch of the game. But we shall see. Gonzaga has struggled with length before, right? And when you watch Florida State walk into the gym, you're like, damn, that looks like an NBA team. Will they struggle tonight?
Well, I think that some of that comes down to their mentality. If you look back to the St. Mary's game, maybe they learned a lesson in that game about getting frustrated, because they got really frustrated in that game and began taking bad shots, trying to, I guess for lack of a better term, try to play a little hero ball. Tried to win their way back into the game with three-pointers that weren't well-considered shots. And so I think it starts there. How do Josh Perkins and Zach Norvell attack? Do they attack patiently, make sure the ball gets to the hands? As well as if the ball gets to the hands of Rui Hachimura and Brandon Clark, that doesn't mean it never comes back. I mean, those guys will pass it back in the right circumstance. So, but if they try to just shoot off of one pass or off of one screen, I think they're putting themselves in a disadvantageous position.
That's the voice of Mike DeCourcy. He's joining us in the Doug Gottlieb Show on Fox Sports Radio. In the game of how do we score against them? That's Texas Tech taking it on Michigan. Who wins?
That's a great question. You know, I have put a lot of faith into Xavier Simpson from having watched him all year. And I think he's the biggest difference between the two teams. Culver is the best player on the floor, the most talented player, but Simpson is a special guy. The question is, for the key for Michigan is that they don't have to get points from any one player to win. That's the difference between the two. I have a hard time seeing Texas Tech score enough points to win if Culver doesn't have at least a good day, if not a great one. Whereas Michigan, against Florida on Saturday, Bazdikas couldn't buy a basket. But that was okay because Jordan Poole was outstanding. They have to have one or two guys that come through on a given day. And if they do, they're usually successful. In this circumstance, can Texas Tech shut them all down? No one has yet. Other teams have outplayed them and outscored them, Michigan State being the most notable. But Michigan State has a lot of weapons, and they have Cassius Winston, who's a difference maker on his own.
Mike DeCourcy joining us in the Doug Gottlieb Show on Fox Sports Radio. Okay, then we have the other games in Louisville. I'm trying to think. We have these other games taking place. We mentioned the Purdue one. There's also Oregon taking on Virginia, and while it's technically a surprise because Oregon struggled so much for most of the regular season, considering they were ranked, and they got healthy, and they won the Pac-12 tournament, not a crazy surprise. Plus, you know, they only had to beat a 13 to get to the Sweet 16. What are your thoughts on Oregon's chances against Virginia?
Well, you know, I to this point in the game, like you said, they had to make sure that they didn't lose their attention against Irvine, and they did what they needed to do to win that. Played a lot, really great basketball down the stretch. Peyton Pritchard, especially. I thought the matchup was really good for them in the first round against Wisconsin, a team that I thought would do well in this tournament based on matchups. And as soon as I saw who was sitting on the opposite bench, not that it's a question of Greg Gard versus Dana Altman, but Dana Altman versus what Wisconsin does against a lot of coaches in this tournament, it would have advantaged Wisconsin, but not against Dana Altman. He was going to know how to handle it, and he did. He did a great job in that game. Oregon has some length and some bounce, and they've got a terrific guard in Peyton Pritchard. But the truth about Virginia is that they have destroyed every team in this field from five on down, and they played quite a few of them. And everyone that they encountered, they just wrecked. There were very few competitive games in that segment. The only team from four on down that they didn't destroy was Florida State in the second meeting, the first time they handled them. So the one thing that we don't know about Virginia is, can they beat the teams with the most talent? I guess they did beat Carolina on the road, and that would be some evidence in their favor. They had two shots at Duke and didn't beat them either time, and for the most part, the rest of it, they just haven't had to face those teams on the 1, 2, and 3 line. So we'll see whether or not they can get through the weekend, but I think that based on their history, they should be able to handle tonight.
Okay, let me ask you a couple, kind of a little bit bigger college basketball questions. What's the most curious hire that's been made to date?
Well, I'm trying to think. Most of the hires, I think, are explicable. I mean, I think that Washington State did a good job with Kyle Smith. I think that was a great idea. I'll be interested to see how Nate Oates, who I think is a terrific coach, translates to the SEC. Recruiting is tough down there, as you know, and he's not a guy who has that long experience in the South. So that'll be an interesting one. I think he's really talented, but it did surprise me that that was the direction that they went. I'm not saying it's a bad hire. I think Nate Oates is a terrific coach, but it looked strange to me. It wasn't one that I would have thought of.
I would generally agree with you in especially in that wording, right? It's not one that you would have thought of. It's like, oh, do I like Nate Oates? Yes. Do I think Alabama's a pretty good job? Yes. Do I think Nate Oates for Alabama makes sense? Yeah, not sure. Not sure.
Yeah.
But, you know, he's shown the ability to go into Detroit and other areas and bring him to Buffalo. If you can win there consistently, just get guys that get players and coach them up. I think that's kind of the same philosophy. What do we make of the SEC having such turnover? Like, it's kind of interesting that you have so much turnover in the SEC.
Yeah, I mean, obviously, I was, like many people, shocked about Vanderbilt. And on a micro level, all the Vanderbilt people were like, we were 0-18, what do you expect? And from a macro level, you understand that these things take time. And the Vanderbilt situation was not good that he inherited. Just because you won games in the years before he got there doesn't mean you're set up to win games in the years he's there. And if recruiting was poor, then you'd say, okay, all right, this is not working. But recruiting had been very successful, and they obviously lost their key point guard in Darius Garland. I think that, when you asked me about most curious, that was the most curious thing I've seen this year. Arkansas, I mean, they'd given Mike a lot of time there. So if they decide they want to go in a different direction, as long as you pay the man, I don't have a problem with it. I don't think that you can necessarily look at it and say anything other than the SEC got better in a hurry. And if you're looking at your situation and you don't feel like you're on top of that wheel, you're going to be on the bottom of it for a while, or at least you fear that. And then you make a move. In some cases, I think that was rash as at Vanderbilt. In some cases, I think it was reasonably considered as at Arkansas.
All right, let's look at the other side of the bracket. Kentucky gets P.J. Washington back, but we don't know if he'll play tomorrow. How does it change Kentucky considering, let's assume he plays this weekend, but it's hard to think he'll be at 100%?
Yeah, that's the problem, is that I think they can get through the Sweet 16 with him limited or absent. I'm not saying it's an automatic. I'm just saying that there are scenarios in which they could put together a team that could be successful. But against Carolina, with the number of weapons they have and their ability to play on the move and their ability to force you to play on the move, I have a hard time seeing, without a high-level PJ, and I don't know whether that's 100 or 80 or somewhere, but somewhere where he's effective. I mean, even you go back to the Louisville game when he didn't score, but he defended Jordan Wara and took him out of the game, and they were able to score enough points to win. But if he's not able to affect the game in some way, I just have a hard time seeing a scenario in which Kentucky could win two this weekend.
Yeah, but especially being a Carolina team that appears to be kind of peaking. Although we don't know the status of one of their star freshmen as well, so that's still kind of up in the air. Duke taking on Virginia Tech. Virginia Tech's beaten them. Of course, they didn't have Zion, but Virginia Tech didn't have their point guard, who might be their best player. What do you think the second time around for Vatek and Duke?
Well, I think that the first thing that Justin Robinson returning does is it allows Nikhil, and I always mix up which direction is Walker Alexander. I always get that wrong. It allows him to be himself again. In the first Duke game, he was basically the point guard and not able to really concentrate on scoring. So he goes back to being that. So now Duke has another guy they have to contend with on offense. But it really comes down to, can they find a way to bother Zion enough that Duke isn't functional or is entirely functional. And, of course, we saw a week ago that UCF had a special weapon in that regard. I mean, they didn't bother Zion that much, maybe some, but they were able to bother enough of the other key players. I don't think anything that happened on Sunday translates to this game tomorrow night, but I do think that they can take the confidence of the first game, that they know they beat Duke. They can say, hey, look, you know, you can say it's Zion, whatever, we didn't have Justin, so we can win this game. And I think going into the game with some confidence certainly helps, but you have to be able to find a way to keep Zion from dominating the lane at both ends. And that's a formula. Doug, a week ago, I had a piece on sportingnews.com in which I talked to maybe a half dozen ACC coaches, a couple from outside the league, something like that, and I gave them full anonymity. Just go ahead and pick apart his game. And they all basically said, he's wonderful, he's tremendous, he's almost impossible to stop. I couldn't even get anybody to say anything bad. They just said, try to crowd him if you can do it. Make the other guys beat you. And most of the teams that Duke has played have sort of tried some variation of that and haven't been successful.
I think Virginia Tech gives them a hell of a game. All right, then we got Houston. You mentioned you think Kentucky can be good enough without P.J. Washington. I mean, this Houston team is deep. They're talented. They're older. Corey Davis and Armani Brooks, they did this thing last year. Are we brushing aside Houston? Could they be the surprise of the weekend?
Sure. They're certainly capable. They've won a lot of games. They beat LSU early in the year. Won the regular season in the league, including finishing ahead of Cincinnati and UCF, both terrific teams. And we saw, you know, what each of them were capable over the last couple of weeks. So they certainly are everything you said. Plus, they're really well coached by Kelvin, who I know you went against quite a few times, and you know he's really good. And so they're certainly, and just as I said, I could see a scenario where Kentucky could win without PJ. I wouldn't be at all shocked if Houston were to win that game. I just wonder again, can they come up with a game plan that slows down four scorers at once and slows down the pace of the Carolina team, presuming they face them? That's the question that I would have. I really admire this Houston team, but I just wonder if the firepower is quite there to stick with Carolina if they played each other in the regional final.
Awesome stuff. Mark DeCourcy covers college basketball for both the Big Ten Network and for the Sporting News. Follow him on Twitter at TSN Mike, or of course, go to their website and you can check out his two big projects he's working on next week, getting you ready for the Final Four in Minneapolis. Mike, great stuff this season. Enjoy the weekend. Thanks for joining us.
Thanks, Doug.
Be sure to catch live editions of the Doug Gottlieb Show weekdays at noon Eastern, 3 p.m. Pacific.
Right now, the Bengals, of course, they could offer a new contract to Andy Dalton. Dalton coming off a year where their defense was the worst in the National Football League and was trending to be the worst in the history of the National Football League before a change was made. And of course, defensive coordinator was fired and Marvin Lewis took over calling the defense. But I find this super interesting that they're going to make Andy Dalton prove that he is, in fact, worthy of being a franchise quarterback. Or at least that's what they're doing in Cincinnati, right? They're not going to give in, and they're not going to blink, and they're not going to flinch, and they're not going to... And Dalton is like Joe Flacco without playoff success. You know? That's what he is. I mean, for Dalton's career, look at the numbers. 20, 27, 33, 19, 25, 18, 25, 21, all touchdowns. He had 1 year with 20 interceptions. Otherwise, it's mid to low teens. And he's about mid-80s to upper 80s in terms of quarterback rating. He missed the last five games of the year this year. He missed three games previously. He's just fine, solid. And what's interesting about the Brown family deciding to not, hey, we're not going to re-up him until we have to, let's let it play out, is, doesn't this feel like exactly what the Dallas Cowboys should do? I guess the difference is Dak has been playing on a first contract, which is a fourth-round pick contract with this. This is Andy Dalton's second contract. But if a guy has been just okay, why overpay him in the last year of a deal? Let him play it out. And if you still can't come to an agreement, you could always franchise tag him, have him make a bunch of money. That's 2 years you could franchise tag him before you ever, you got 3 years if you're the Cowboys. There's a lot of people who have been critical of the Bengals for their decisions to not fire Marvin Lewis a year ago and some of the other decisions. But I will tell you that while they are, by some people's estimation, cheap, I kind of think they're frugal or more smart with their money, especially with Andy Dalton, who no one thinks blows you away.
Fox Sports Radio has the best sports talk lineup in the nation. Catch all of our shows at foxsportsradio.com. And within the iHeartRadio app, search FSR to listen live.
He's a MLB on Fox analyst. He's a World Series champion, and he makes coffee nervous. He's Nick Swisher. He joins us on the Doug Gottlieb Show on Fox Sports Radio. Swish, our guys, like, you have spring training. It's a different buildup than any other sport. You usually play a couple games in the big park after coming up from spring training. I'm just wondering, opening day, are you truly ready? Is it, I need a couple weeks to get ready? Are you past ready? Like, what's it really like to be a major leaguer when all the pageantry of opening day starts?
Oh, bro, I mean, it's the greatest day of the year, right? Everybody starts off with zeros. Everybody thinks they have a chance to win the World Series today. And that's an amazing thing, right? I also feel like, and what I said from a couple of the shows we did yesterday, was just talking about this is the time for ballparks to shine. This is the time for them to show you what they are, what they represent. And I think for everybody, from the Cincinnati Reds all the way to the Los Angeles Dodgers, right, everybody's stoked about days like this. And I think for everybody, man, the nerves never go away. The flyovers, the whole nine, everything about this is amazing. You know, and to the point of whether you think guys are ready or not, you know, from being in spring training for I don't know how many years I did that, but also, too, even this year, you still feel like guys are saying, hey, spring training's a little too long. Because if you're a hitter, you probably need anywhere from 30 to 50 at-bats to get yourself ready for the season. Pitchers, they don't need that much. These guys have been throwing all off-season. They're ready to go. So I think pitchers think it might be a little longer spring training than most. But then again, they do show up a week earlier, so maybe that does it.
Yeah, you mentioned you need, what would you say, 30 to 50 at-bats to feel like you're ready?
I was thinking anywhere from 30 to 50, maybe 30 to 50 is what I would say that you need to do to get yourself ready to go.
Okay, so this is, and I'm asking, this is part of this for radio show, part of this is for, I got a kid who loves baseball and he's a pretty good little ball player. Okay, so like day of the game, opening day, a lot of day baseball games.
Of course.
What's the general schedule? Like, do you get in? Do you get in and hit in the cages? Do you only hit at BP? Like, what is the general schedule?
Well, pretty much it's set up for your day game schedule, right? Your day game routine. That's pretty much what it is. The only thing that is different about opening day is everything starts about 15 to 20 minutes earlier because they want to do the whole thing, right? They want to, you know, do the national anthem, make that sound amazing, right? The flyovers, everything's planned out. So I think that it just depends. Some teams do BP on the field that day because they haven't been in that ballpark for a minute. They want to get used to it, right? Or they might say, hey, we feel good. You know, we'll hit in the cages today. We want to make sure our field's absolutely immaculate. But nothing really changes. It's just your day game routine. It's your 1 o'clock start routine. Just like you have your 6:35 and your 7 o'clock start.
But what does that mean? Like, you get there,
okay, so
1 o'clock start. Like, go. 1 o'clock start, go.
Okay, so I'm up at 8:30. Right? Grab a little breakfast, right? I'm probably heading to the ballpark at 9:30, 10, depending on the day, right? Most of the days that you don't take batting practice, you get to the ballpark at around 11 o'clock, right? You get yourself ready, right? You go in there, you do your stretching, your massages, do whatever you need to do in the training room, right? And then that's when you start putting your jersey on, right? You put your pants on, you got your t-shirt on, you go down, you maybe hit in the cage a little bit, come back, put your jersey on about that time. It's showtime, right? The day's about to start. All the, you know, ceremonies and everything of opening day are getting ready to start. And at that point, that's when the nerves really start to kick in. And hopefully you did as much as you could in the cage, because when you go out there on that big field, man, there's nothing like it.
Okay, so I'm watching right now. The Angels are taking on the Oakland A's. I bring up Oakland because that was your first team.
Of course.
And, you know, you got 04, you got called up. But 05, you were on the opening day roster. I guess
right.
I remember high school and both in college, like That first time you see that uniform hanging in the locker, do you remember at all what the first opening day was like when you're in the big leagues?
Oh, yeah, man. Oh, yeah, just like it was yesterday. I feel like I could probably rattle off maybe all 12, 13 opening days that I was able to be part of. I feel like those days just separate themselves just because of what it is, right? You know me, I'm an energy guy. You know, yep. I feed off the energy in the building, and I always thought for myself that those opening days, man, every ballpark was packed. Even the worst team in baseball last year, opening day is going to have a packed stadium. And for those guys that don't get a chance to play in front of those crowds, it's an amazing thing, man. It's something that's hard to describe because the sounds are different. The energy is different. So I think for myself, man, anytime you could play opening day in front of those big crowds, that's when you wanted to shine most.
By the way, you got a hit in your first opening day. I don't know if you know that. You guys lost the Baltimore Orioles, but you got a hit.
That's right. I'll take it, bro.
Do you remember who was off of?
That's what you want to do. That's what you want to do day one.
Do you remember who was off of?
Get out of the way.
It was I don't know who the hit was off of. These are the pitchers. Oh, actually, I do know. It was Rodrigo Lopez you had a hit off of.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Man, you're taking me way back right there. Yeah. What a name.
There you go, Rodrigo Lopez. Nick Swisher joining us on the Doug Gottlieb Show. Bryce Harper, in The Athletic did a poll, and players voted him the most overrated player, but also the most feared player. What do you think? When you hear the name Bryce Harper, what do you think?
A lot. All that stuff that comes to mind is what you're saying. So I think for me, you know, Bryce Harper is one of those guys that maybe for the last year, we expect so much out of these guys. And obviously when you sign a $330 million contract, there's a lot to live up to. Is it even possible? I'm not sure, right? We haven't seen one of these long-term deals really pay out yet. But I think for myself, as down as people have been on Bryce Harper in the past, they should be jumping on the bandwagon now. And I'll tell you why. This is a fresh start, right? This kid is going to a blue-collar, hard-working town in Philadelphia where sports are king now, right? Sports are enormous in Philly. And for where the Philadelphia Phillies were last year and where they are right now, moving themselves towards getting themselves back to the 2008s and the 2009s, right, when they had, you know, their World Series runs. I think that this guy can be a key part of that. I think you have a lot of guys over there. They brought over a whole heap of individuals and all great baseball players. You brought over Andrew McCutchen to play left field, right? You brought over Gene Segura to play shortstop, right, who averages 200 hits a game. You brought over a guy like David Robertson, and if you're a fan of the Yankees, you know exactly what this guy brings to the table. Gabe Kapler's in his second year. I was able to talk to him when I was in spring training a couple weeks ago before the Phillies played the Yanks. And I was standing there with him and Brian Cashman, and we were just chit-chatting, and I was like, are you going to get your guy? And obviously talking about Bryce Harper. And he says, Swish, I have no idea, but I hope to God we do. And for me, if your manager is saying that, right, with everything that comes along with Bryce Harper, that's excitement. And I think with where Philly is, they'll be knocking on the door, and don't be surprised if they're a dark horse pushing for a World Series bid in the National League.
This is the Doug Gottlieb Show on Fox Sports Radio. Nick Swisher is our guest. Yankees have a bunch of names that you would know. They got rid of Sonny Gray. That marriage didn't quite work. CC is gone. I guess the question is, do they have the pitching to keep up with the Red Sox?
Yeah, I think at the end of the day, if you look at the New York Yankees, you know two things are going to happen. The back end of their bullpen has the chance to be legendary with people like Adam Ottavino that came over from the Colorado Rockies. You've got Dylan Betances, who's been an all-star almost every year he's been in the league. Aroldis Chapman, we don't need to say much about that guy. We know what he does. Zach Britton throwing 95, 96 miles an hour. I think he set the consecutive saves record for Major League Baseball. Along with guys like Chad Green, I think the strength of the New York Yankees lineup is in the back end of their bullpen. This ball club is set up to score early and the game's over. Because just like you see in playoff baseball, you score a couple runs early, all of a sudden you start, here come all the flamethrowers, right? And in a one-game set, I think the Yanks have a better chance than anybody because batters 1 through 9 have the ability to hit the ball out of the ballpark at any time. So there's going to be two things going to happen for the Yankees this year. Their bullpen is going to be phenomenal, and they're going to hit a whole lot of home runs. The one question mark, like you're asking, is their starting pitching. What are they going to have, right? You know, obviously, Luis Severino, who signed that four-year deal for $40 million, he's hurt right now. He's going to be down for a little bit. Tanaka took the ball today, did a tremendous job. I think you saw the sign of Gio Gonzalez, who kind of bounced around last year, I think ended up with Milwaukee Brewers. But to bring him over, a veteran left-handed guy in Yankee Stadium, well, obviously a short porch and right, I think you're going to see him come up. I think he's going to have to. I think, obviously, with C.C. Sabathia in the last year of his deal, going to retire after this year. I'm a homer, Doug. You know me. I'm a Yankee guy, bro. I got those stripes in me. But I look on the other side, and I see the Boston Red Sox. And
all right, let's work on getting out. I want a couple more picks here.
I don't know where I stopped talking, bro, but I feel like I was talking about the back end of their bullpen, right?
Yes.
The strength of their squad. And that's true. And I think the Yanks have just as good a shot as anybody in the American League. Teams like the Houston Astros have a chance. And also the defending champ, let's be honest, the Boston Red Sox, man. The only difference in their lineup this year is they don't have Craig Kimbrel, their closer from last year. That can be a question mark moving forward.
Sure.
But when you have guys like J.D. Martinez, Mookie Betts, Andrew Benintendi, I mean, Xander Bogaerts, the list goes on and on, David Price, Chris Sale, you usually feel like your chances are pretty good. And Chris Sale's happy. He got his contract. David Price has got his contract. No one's doing it for the money. They're doing it for the pride. They love Boston, and if they have an opportunity, this may be, I mean, I'm not saying this is, but there's a chance that this could be, this team could get themselves back to the World Series multiple years.
Okay, so who's the sneaky team? Give me the team that you're like, because we all know the Astros, we all know the Red Sox,
yeah, totally.
We know the Yankees, right? Who's the, I mean, even the Brewers are not a sneaky team considering Yelich and all the talent that they have. Who's the team that we should be talking about first in the American League?
Sneaky team as in, going to win a championship sneaky?
Or they're going to end up, you think, if things go right, like, you started with the premise of everybody's got a chance to win the World Series. Like, that's not really, right. Like, the Marlins aren't winning the World Series. Like, I'm an Angel fan, they're not winning the World Series.
24 hours, bro.
Okay. So I'm not trying to be a buzzkill, but I'm trying to get you back in your wheelhouse. Give me an American and National League team that you think, are they going to win a championship? Maybe not, but they're a lot better and are a lot more deserving of conversation now because they will get that conversation later.
Hands down, Tampa Bay Rays, no doubt, 150%. They won 90 games last year, and we didn't even know about them.
I didn't know that either. I honestly had no idea.
Since they moved to the opener, right, which they established what an opener is, right? They're the first team that really kind of used it all year long, right? Which is funny because they had the Cy Young Award winner from last year, Blake Snell, as their number one, right? But the Tampa Bay Rays have found something that works for them, right? I feel like, Kevin Cash has done a great job down there. I had the chance to play with him a couple years. The guy knows what he's doing. They know their guys. And the only thing they've done is brought over better pitching. So I think that even though you don't know what they did last year, you might hear a little bit about them this year. They're a tremendous team. They don't have a high payroll. They don't have the big name players. Tommy Pham is one that comes to mind. Blake Snell, right? This team right here, man, is going to make that AL East difficult, right? As good as the Red Sox and the Yankees are, the Tampa Bay Rays, if they would have been in the American League Central last year, they would have been going to the playoffs. So, I think that's the team that you really need to look out for in the American League. And I think it's not a sneaky team. But I think, most of the time when you talk about the National League, you talk about teams like the Los Angeles Dodgers. You talk about the Chicago Cubs, right? I think with what happened last year in the NL East, with the Atlanta Braves doing as well as they did, I'm not sure that's going to be the same thing that's going to happen to them this year. I think the Washington Nationals are going to see them back. And I think the dark horse in the National League, I think, would be the Philadelphia Phillies, right? I know they're not a sneaky team. We know everything that they've done, but no one's really picking them to be in the World Series. They're still saying, yeah, this is a great team moving forward. But I think for myself, I think this team has what it takes, man. I think they've got the moxie. I think they have the leadership. I think they have the openness to analytics and making their teams better. I don't know, man. I guess I'm a Gabe Kapler fan at heart, and I think that team is going to push the Dodgers, and the Cubs and the Nationals. I really think Philadelphia Phillies have a good shot to see themselves playing at the end of October.
Doug Gottlieb Show here on Fox Sports Radio. That is the voice of the one and only Nick Swisher. Swish, love your energy. Love having you on. Still haven't gotten you on the tennis court. We'll do that soon. Thanks so much for joining
us. Hey, brother. Hey, I'm getting myself right, bro. I'm getting myself back in shape. I'll be there, baby. I'll be there.
All right, we'll talk soon. That's Nick Swisher, who makes coffee nervous.